Okay. Okay. So I'm going to talk about using kinetic inductance detectors for dark matter detection. So this is very much along the lines of what Matt just talked about. So that was a great introduction. I won't have to go over kind of the basics of the photon physics. I'll focus on how kids might be used and what kind of the limiting factors are. Oops, I don't have that. All right, so here's an overview of the talk. I'll just go over some basics of kids because they are somewhat more complicated than TESs. I'll give you a couple calculations for the expected energy resolution possible, and this depends on the type of architecture you use. And then I'll talk a little bit about the progress we've made in the lab to date. Okay, so this is a basic introduction to kids. So this is from Peter Day's Nature paper. So the basic idea is that superconductors have an AC inductance due to the inertia of the Cooper pairs, or you can think of it as the fact that there's magnetic energy stored in the screening supercurrent. And when that inductance will change when Cooper pairs are broken, when you deposit energy, whether you deposit it by photons, by phonons, et cetera, creating quasiparticles. And so we sense the change by putting the kid in a resonant circuit and monitoring the resonant frequency. So here we put the kid as part of the inductance in a notch LC resonator. And you can see the transmission through the circuit has a notch at the designed resonant frequency. And then when the inductance changes in response to energy input, the resonant frequency goes down, the inductance goes up, and the quality factor, the dissipation in the resonator, increases. So the resonant dip gets wider and shifts upward. So if you put in a sine wave at the original resonant frequency, you'll see a phase shift and an amplitude change on that sine wave when energy is absorbed. And a key thing is that because superconductors have very low loss, you can have these resonances can be very, very sharp, providing a natural way to multiplex. So this is from a review paper from Ben quite a while ago. The basic idea is that you create a bunch of sine waves, you sum them up, you run them through your cryostat and your detector array, amplify, and then you demultiplex each of the sine waves, where each sine wave is designed to hit a certain one of the resonators in your array of resonances. So this is the basic principle on why kids have been pursued for many kinds of detection. And one of the key things here is that the only cryogenic element you need is this low noise amplifier. So that's very simple compared to many other technologies. All right, so let me talk about how you actually predict the response of a kid. So first of all, you have to figure out how to go from quasiparticles to what the change in the conductivity of the material is. So there's a theory that was worked out many, many years ago by Madison Bardeen for what the response of the conductivity is to in a BCS superconductor when quasiparticles are created. There's little features here about exactly what limit you have to be in, but it turns out that the limit they used is actually accurate for most films that we work with. And so you get two calculations of the real and imaginary part of the conductivity that just have to do with interactions between the electromagnetic field and the electrons in the superconductor. One piece is a resistive response, one piece is a reactive response. And you really can think of it as two different fluids that are exchanging energy with each other. This model is only a good approximation for some materials. It works quite well for aluminum. It doesn't work well for some other more interesting superconductors or when you put a lot of readout power in the kid. But I'll stick with this just to keep things simple. So we basically just use these as sort of engineering model inputs, and we don't worry too much about the superconductivity, except when things get too interesting. So here are some plots of what the kind of important parameters are. So this is the quasiparticle density in the superconductor normalized to basically the density of states times the gap as a function of the temperature over the critical temperature. So the thermally generated quasiparticle density drops off exponentially, as you expect, because it's a gap material. These are the real and imaginary parts of the complex conductivity normalized to the complex conductivity at zero temperature. So they also drop off exponentially because of the dropping quasiparticle density. But when you calculate the fractional responsivity, so the fractional change in the real or the imaginary conductivity, the ratio of the change in the conductivity to the imaginary conductivity at zero temperature, it turns out that this is a very gentle function of temperature. So you don't have a calibration problem because things are changing exponentially with temperature. There's some, in some limits, there are some nice simple equations that tell you what all these numbers are. And in particular, the responsivities, the fractional responsivities, are just proportional to the actual conductivities themselves. So these turn out to be pretty simple equations to work with. So As I mentioned, the quasiparticle density nominally decreases exponentially as temperature decreases, but Ben mentioned how that people observe typically sort of residual densities of quasiparticles at the 10 to 100 per cubic micron level. That might be due to subgap states that kind of trap quasiparticles and prevent them from recombining with one another. It may be due to some sort of power input on the sensor. It hasn't been worked out in detail, and it may be different in different situations. And then also you have to worry about making sure that there isn't some mechanism for creating quasiparticles that you're not accounting for. But the key thing is that the responsivity is only weakly dependent on temperature. Okay, so then we have to go from the conductivity to something we can observe. So we talk in terms of the surface impedance of the film. So think about an electromagnetic wave propagating normal to the surface of your kid film. And you can calculate what the complex conductivity is. And it's the complex impedance, and it's just related to the complex conductivities and the thicknesses of the film. And so then the parameters that we worry about are the fractional change in the overall impedance, which gives one piece that's the fractional change in the inductance, the kinetic inductance, and a fractional change in the ratio of the change in the resistance to the reactance. So this is sort of a kinetic resistance. So if we know what the surface impedances are, we can go back to the quasiparticle density. So this stuff is all pretty straightforward, at least for aluminum and other BCS-like materials. So then what do you actually see? You monitor the transmission, S21, the RF transmission through a circuit, and it's just related to some quality factors that are related to the quasiparticle density and to the kinetic inductance fraction. So this is the fraction of the total inductance of the film that's kinetic. So you can calculate all these things. And so, as I mentioned before, the nice thing is that these quality factors tend to be quite high for superconductors, and so you can monitor the response by simply seeing what the change in the phase and amplitude of your sine wave that you probe a given resonance with is. The phase response is telling you about how much the frequency of the resonance is shifting as a function of time, and then the amplitude response is telling you how the dissipation of the resonator is changing with time. You do have to make sure that you account for the fact that you only are sensitive to audio signals within the resonator bandwidth. So if you make your quality factors too high, that reduces the signal bandwidth you have, which, depending on your interest in the rising edge of your pulse, may or may not be interesting. And as was recognized many years ago by Jonas, Smidzinus, and others, the quickly evolving gigahertz digital electronics make the prospect of doing this all digitally very straightforward. Okay, so then what do the quasiparticles do in response to energy input? Well, we find that the quasiparticle lifetime, the time it takes for a quasiparticle to go away after it's been created, does tend to have the saturation effect, where there's some maximum lifetime that corresponds to some residual quasiparticle density, N star. And this has been measured in a variety of different films. It's different for different films. So this is some measurements for tantalum and some measurements for aluminum. It approaches milliseconds or even a few milliseconds in aluminum, generally lower for tantalum because it's a higher gap material. But it is hard to make, this thing does never seems to go up exponentially as it's supposed to. So you do end up with this maximum quasiparticle lifetime you have to worry about. And these higher lifetimes, you may have to do it at very low readout powers, which then affects the signal-to-noise relative to amplifier noise. So you have to worry about these effects when you're calculating your sensitivity. So this is tantalum relaxation time in microseconds. So it goes from 1 microsecond to 100 microseconds. And then this is relaxation time in aluminum, going from 10 microseconds to 1,000 microseconds. So some of these are aluminum films, the red and the triangles, and then some of these are tantalum films, the boxes and the dots. So it's just showing that these lifetimes, the BCS says they should go up exponentially at low temperature, they tend to saturate. And this is just another more recent measurement in what appear to be better aluminum films that have higher lifetimes going up to 6 milliseconds, but these feed line powers are very, very low compared to what we typically like to use. Okay, so what governs the way quasiparticles are created and disappear is the generation recombination equation. So on the left side, you have all the powers that are going into your kid that can create quasiparticles. And on the right side, you have sort of a detailed balance equation, which is one piece is the recombination of quasiparticles with each other. So there's one term that goes as the square of the quasiparticle number or density. And then there's this tau max effect, where it just looks like there's a lifetime that you saturate at. And this is probably due to some residual quasiparticles, but it's not described in the standard way. And so you can work out how all these things are related to another. The key thing is that when you're operating a kid in calorimetric mode, so basically some pulse-like energy deposition goes in, tau QP, the quasi-particle lifetime, gives you the decay time for the pulse. So you just expect an exponentially decaying pulse with a pulse height that's given by the energy, the conversion of the input energy to quasiparticles based on the gap energy and a decay time given by the quasiparticle lifetime. So that's what you expect to see, and that's what I'll use for making at least a first order estimate of the expected energy resolution. And then of course you can get back to this from what you observe using the Mattis-Bardeen and other equations that I talked about earlier. So just as long as BCS works for your material, everything is calculable. It's just the equations tend to be more complicated than for a TS. If the material is not BCS, then many of these things have to be calibrated completely empirically. Okay, so then what are the noises that matter? So these are in terms of noise equivalent power. So this is the thing that you integrate over some bandwidth to figure out what your energy resolution is. So there's generation recombination noise, and there's a couple different kinds of generation recombination noise. There's the generation recombination noise just due to the quiescent quasi-particle density that's present, say, thermally. So I know I work a lot of millimeter wave detectors, and there we worry about the quasi-particles that are created optically. But here we only have to worry about the ones that are created thermally. And then there is the prospect that you can create quasi-particles with readout power. And this is a strange process in that you obviously read these things out at frequencies that are well below the gap energy, so a few gigahertz down below a gigahertz, and whereas the gap energy corresponds to 100 gigahertz, 80 gigahertz in aluminum. But multi-photon processes, when you have lots of readout photons around, can actually result in creation of quasi-particles from readout power. So PA here is the readout power. And there's some efficiency that, is not, it's hard to calculate theoretically, but you can go and measure what's the probability that readout power will create quasi-particles. So there's going to be a generation recombination noise for the quasi-particles that are created from the readout power. And then there's basically a readout electronics noise term, which is just the fact that you have a noisy amplifier looking at the kid, and that results in a voltage fluctuation on the signal that the amplifier is receiving. So you have to factor that in. But these things are all calculable. These chi factors tend to be of order unity. They're just kind of correction factors. But you can see the lifetime enters in. Obviously, the efficiency for energy to get into the kit enters in. The lower your efficiency, the poorer your NEP. The number of quasiparticles present quiescently factors in. You get the same factors for both dissipation and frequency, except there's an extra correction factor for frequency because the signal size is effectively larger. So the noise temperature, the amplifier noise looks better in frequency units because beta is bigger than one, and it's typically of order a few. But then the frequency readout suffers from this so-called two-level system noise, which is basically defects in the substrate underneath your kid or in dielectrics on your kid or near your kid. There are states in them, two-level states, that consist of defects where there's maybe two or more configurations, and these states switch back and forth and randomly, driven by the electric field of the resonator. And you're effectively changing the dielectric constant that the resonator sees when these things switch back and forth. So because the frequency of the resonance depends on the dielectric constant, it's like the frequency of the resonance is wiggling around. But it's a pure frequency noise because it doesn't affect the dissipation, it only affects the frequency. And so it factors in here when you're trying to make a frequency measurement, but doesn't factor into the dissipation readout. So then these are, again, just some order unity factors. I think I said all that. Okay, so what's a characteristic energy resolution? So I'll do this in sort of the simplest possible way, where you assume that a delta function energy deposition, so you're basically just treating the kid like a calorimeter where energy comes in and it's absorbed immediately. We assume what we think is a fairly conservative assumption, which is that the quasi-particle population is dominated by what's created by readout power. We don't know what this A to A term is, but we can include it as a parametric factor. So the noise on that's what's setting the quasi-particle density. We assume the dissipation readout, so we don't have to worry about TLS noise. And then we assume that the amplifier noise is dominant, which should be true, but it may be that at very low resolutions, we do have to worry about the generation recombination noise on the quasi-particles that have been created by the readout power. But you can calculate a fairly simple formula for what the expected energy resolution is. Here are some order unity factors. This is that creation probability. The gap energy, the superconductor factors in just because you're converting energy to quasi-particles. Here's the volume of the superconductor, that of the active region of the superconductor, the amplifier noise temperature, and then this is the sort of intrinsic surface quality factor of the film, how good of a superconductor it is. And this is an order of unity factor that's basically the responsivity. So if you put in some numbers, it tells you that, okay, this is interesting, that you could get of order 100 milli-EV resolutions for using just standard aluminum and standard amplifier noise temperatures, reasonable volume. So this is actually a fairly big resonator, but one that would be good for coupling to a substrate of order a centimeter in size and for reasonable quality factors, things that, you know, quality factors typical of those measured. And if A to A is really small, which it's expected to be, sort of less than 10%, then this improves substantially. You can clearly do better if you use a lower gap superconductor. You're just creating more quasi-particles for a certain amount of energy. And obviously, if you can build a better amplifier, then that also helps. But this is what's telling us that it's worthwhile to look at kids for doing dark matter detection at very low recoil energies. Okay, so now the architecture that you can use, though, depends on what kind of energy resolution you want to get to and what type of particles you're looking for. So for the things that I think are probably have been of more interest here, the sort of sub-EV energy detection with gram scale targets, so all the things that have been talked about, like dark photon absorption, DM electron scattering at low dark matter masses, and then scalar media nucleon scattering at very low recoil energies. There's two obvious methods, both of which have been talked about. Well, so the optical phonon production has been talked about twice here. And then there's, of course, the direct production of quasiparticles in a superconductor. But then the idea is that you'd allow those quasiparticles to recombine in the bulk target superconductor and then produce athermal phonons that then you would detect with your kids. So you're either looking for the athermal phonons produced directly by an interaction, like Matt and Simon talked about, or the athermal phonons that are produced by quasiparticles that have been created by dark matter scattering that then recombine. And it's always favorable to look for the phonons because quasiparticle propagation is a much more diffusive phenomenon than phonon propagation. There are many more ways for quasiparticles to get trapped and decay than for phonons. So I think it's always preferable to try to use phonons. So this is now just a single kid, one would put on a few millimeter scale target substrate. And the calculation I did on the previous slide is roughly valid for that kind of kid, assuming that the energy gets into the kid quickly enough and you don't lose the energy to other loss mechanisms like Matt was just talking about. So we either need lower gap superconductors, we need A to A to be small, which it probably is. But there are better amplifiers on the way. So there's a kinetic inductance parametric amplifier that's providing sort of very broad bandwidth at radio frequencies that's now shown a noise temperature that's basically quantum limited, so about a factor of 100 below previous typical noise temperatures. So this looks viable, but it's something that hasn't really been, a lot of effort has not gone into this type of architecture yet. Okay, and then the architecture we've been kind of more focused on due simply to evolution from CDMS is to use large detectors that are using the Neganov-Luke Trofimov phonon amplification. So this would be sort of more like your traditional nuclear recoil search, but pushing down to lower recoil energies around 10 eV recoil. Or, as has been talked about, dark matter electron scattering at EV scale, so producing, again, EV type of energies in the detector. So we'd use the obvious thing to do is to use the electric field production of phonons, so amplifying the electron hole pair signal has been shown both in CDMS light and super CDMS to date, but then very nicely in this recent paper from some portions of CDMS where single electron hole pair detection is seen. So there's, again, two types of architectures that you might go to depending on exactly what energy range you're looking at, either a few kids on a centimeter scale substrate or many more kids on a larger sort of CDMS scale substrate. And as Matt mentioned, the issue is you have to do, as you go up in target mass, WIMP mass that you're looking for, dark matter mass that you're looking for, the backgrounds become more important. And we've been pursuing using lots of kids on a large substrate in order to do position fiducialization and make sure that you really are sure that you're rejecting the outer edges of the detector, which we think will be easier to do with more finely pixelized measurement of the phonon signal. So you pay a price in energy resolution because you basically suffer root n in energy resolution as you increase the number of kids, but obviously it gives you much more position information, which would be necessary to make sure that you really can exclude the edges of the detector. So this is sort of the scale of substrate that you'd be looking at for these two types of detector.
So what is the
energy resistance? Here it is. So it's a bit more complicated because now you have to factor in the process of the phonons getting to the sensor, you know, how much of the area you cover, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a somewhat more complicated formula for getting the energy resolution. Oops. Oh, God, I have to go through it again. Let me stop at the right one. OK. It's got sort of the same pieces. You can see here the amplifier noise temperature again. Sorry, it's TN instead of TA here. The same responsivity number. But now you have to do things like, say, make sure that the quality factor of the resonator is not so large that it prevents you from seeing the phone on rise time, because you'd like to use that to do part of the position information determination. So that factors in. How much of the area of the substrate you cover? What's the probability that a phonon will actually break a pair when it goes into your kid before bouncing back out? What's the lifetime, the resonant frequency? This is, again, the readout power creation probability. The kinetic inductance fraction now plays a bigger role in this type of architecture. And then the probability for a phonon to enter the kid per try. Yep. No, sort of millimeter scale, but what was motivating us to pursue the more finely pixelized version was not position resolution per se, but making sure that we minimize misreconstruction, right? We want to make sure that we avoid misreconstructing events from the outside into the center of the detector. And that seemed a situation where, you know, with the CDMS, where we only have 12 phonon sensors that are kind of broadly spread, this would make it much easier to avoid such misreconstructions. But again, it's driven entirely. That's driven more by the backgrounds rather than by the energy resolution.
Right. Yeah. No. I guess I was
just
curious, like
position. We in a prototype device.
I guess you would optimize it and decide it.
Yeah, but we made a 2 cm by 2 cm prototype device with 20 kids, and that showed easily millimeter scale position resolution. So that's really not that difficult. What we haven't characterized is how. What is the level of misreconstruction you get for events near the outer edges of the detector, which right now, since we're working with just 1 mm thick substrates, it's kind of not really appropriate to do it yet. I think once we get to 1 cm substrates, that'll be an important study, you know, actually putting a source at the outside and seeing how frequently you misreconstruct. Okay, so so there's a bunch of factors here. Many of them are the same, some of them are different, but again, I put in some sort of typical numbers for aluminum, and you find that you can get sort of, so 22 eV, give or take a factor of order unity, types of energy resolution. So, yep.
I feel like the readout power, doesn't it need to have a factor of Q in there because it's the internal power that's built up in the resonator?
Yeah, but you take that when you're setting the resonator bandwidth in order to make sure you can recover the phone on rise time, that factor gets absorbed somewhere else. You're making certain assumptions about how the resonator bandwidth is connected to the desired readout bandwidth. So FR kind of comes in instead of the Q. No, but I understand what you're talking about, and there's in the process of calculating this equation, there's a connection between the readout frequency and the Q and the desired final signal bandwidth, so that Q gets replaced by a factor of the readout frequency. Okay, but again, this is definitely in the ballpark of being interesting if you can get all these factors to be of order unity so that you aren't losing lots of phonons through other processes or things like that. Oh, right, density states. Just in case you missed it. Okay, so where are we on actually making these things? So we've been working on a kid design that's intended to, this was, again, motivated by starting with the large detectors, but this would be appropriate for still a millimeter to few millimeter cross-section substrate. So the films are sort of 10 to 30 nanometers thick. The inductor here, it's a symmetric coplanar strip design. So the idea here is that the kid sensitivity to quasiparticle scales as the current on the resonator squared. So if you have a resonator that has a very large position dependence to the current, then you effectively have dead regions of the resonator. And those dead regions can still absorb phonons. And so they suck out signal, but you may not see the signal. So we wanted to make the current uniform. So what you're seeing is the current density in the inductor. And you can see it's fairly uniform, except for some small regions that are a little dark. And at least for aluminum, this scale is such that quasiparticles, once created, would diffuse out of those regions. So you would have good sensitivity to them. I think we have something like 95% current density uniformity. You tune the frequency by just varying the inductor length, and it seems to match up. The simulation seems to have a very simple form for how the frequency depends on the inductor length. And this would give you about 10 to the 4 cubic microns of active volume, which is the number that I kind of scaled by in the calculation of earlier that gave 100 milliEV. So this is a reasonable volume for being sensitive enough to get to 100 milliEV type of energy resolutions. We use an interdigitated capacitor because these are known to minimize TLS noise because there's no amorphous dielectrics making the capacitor. And in the long run, we would do this as a two-material kid, where this is made out of niobium and this is made out of aluminum or a lower gap superconductor, because you don't want this region to absorb phonons because it's dead as far as sensitivity. There's no current there. So you'd like to make this out of a very high gap superconductor like niobium that's high enough energy that it won't absorb phonons, or it'll only absorb the most high energy phonons, and they'll have a chance to bounce around again and then get into the inductor. Okay, so then we're working on full wafer designs, again, motivated by the large detector. So the feed line here is a niobium coplanar waveguide, and it's very thick, and that ensures that we get reliable fabrication, because this thing snakes around a lot on the wafer. So this is a 7.5 centimeter wafer, so it's tens of centimeters of feed line. So you have to be sure that you can make it reliably, because this is the one thing that if it fails in only one point, the detector's dead. So we found that we can make these things now quite reliably with these thick films. Notice that the kid doesn't overlap that film at all. So the fabrication is relatively easy. You don't have to worry about, does this connect to this very well? They're completely independent. You cover up one completely when you fabricate the other. The design uses an idea that was developed by Kohler, which is applying these for neutrinoless double beta decay, running the ground plane around the kids. So this helps to prevent nearby kids from coupling to each other. And then this meander, doubly meandered structure also minimizes coupling between nearby kids, which can cause the resonances to move around relative to design. And then we do full fab on a full 7.5 centimeter wafer with a contact mask. The features are fairly large, about 10 microns. So these are now fairly reliable to fabricate. We don't have much trouble making them. A student makes them up at JPL, so we don't even need professionals. All right, so this is an RF test device where we fabricated the kids out of niobium so that we could test it at 4 Kelvin, and also that we'd be able to focus entirely on whether the RF design is matching what it should. So the performance is quite good. We see almost all the 80 resonances we expect. The scatter is quite reasonable, less than about 7 × 10⁻⁴, so about 2.5 megahertz scatter. We don't see any resonators crossing each other. We don't see anything colliding with each other. And that turns out to be actually a quite practical problem. When you're doing an optical detector, you can, of course, map out where your resonances are by shining light on your detector. That's a little harder for dark matter. So it's very important that we'd be able to predict which resonances physically wear on the substrate, or what frequency does that resonance actually correspond to. So that's working well. I think I'll skip the readout stuff since this is we're short on time. Okay, so plan. So as I mentioned, we're kind of working our way up as Matt, kind of a strategy to really make sure we understand everything along the way. So we have fabricated a device with aluminum kids, not niobium kids. So we're getting ready to characterize it. So we'll measure the RF performance, measure the kinetic inductance fraction to provide some of the numbers that go into the sensitivity calculation. And then the next step is to actually expose to X-rays and measure what the baseline energy resolution is, and then energy resolution of few and 30 keV. So these will start to give us some of the numbers that actually will tell us whether our energy resolution matches estimates. So it's almost certain that we will have to refine the design after this first go-through. But then scaling up to thick substrates should be relatively easy. We're using contact masks. All the hardware is designed to handle thick substrates. So we think this will be not that challenging to scale up. And then long term, as I said, this was more kind of focused on extending the CDMS technology to slightly lower masses. So I think we need to reconsider the design in light of trying to do very good energy resolution down for sub-EV depositions. It's not clear at all that resonator design is really optimal for that kind of experiment. So I think that's it. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Yes.
So one thing that worries me for both your design and Matt's design, any of the calorimetric designs, is how do you cool the sample and read it out without having all your phonons leak out through your supports? Like, CDMS has experience with this. So, I mean, what is the minimum thermal, how do you hold your sample mechanically rigidly, but so all your phonons don't get out? And how do you get all the wires in without the phonons getting out the wires?
Yeah, so I mean, I think Matt actually addressed that, in that we find, in the CDMS detectors, we find that the loss of phonons, so you know, as you mentioned, when we scaled down the amount of surface that was covered, that's exactly the time when you'd expect to lose signal because you haven't changed the way you mounted the detector, but you've reduced the area that's actually active, right? And as Matt said, the measurements are consistent with less than a 1% loss of phonons, either to losses at the edges of the surface due to what he was talking about, or simply just losses to the clamps. So we think that's actually under good control for CDMS size detectors. Now, actually, in the smaller devices that we tested a while ago, we did find that we had a very low phonon absorption probability, around 7%. And our concern was that either that was due to the dead metal on the surface, because everything was aluminum, or it was due to the clamps, because effectively the surface area of the clamps to the ratio of the surface area of the clamps to the surface area of the entire detector was higher than for a CDMS detector. So that was one of the reasons we went to the scale-up, was to reduce the fraction of the area that was in the clamp. So we'll see here what kind of phonon collection probability we get and whether we see any indication that we're losing things to the clamps. Other questions? Okay.
So here is a very simple question. So It seems that both TES and KITS are aiming for the low energy resolution detection. So can you just do a very quick summary on which is good and bad on each side?
Certainly from the point of view of just calculating the energy resolution, on theory, both of them seem quite capable of it.
Yeah.
So it comes to the things that kill you. Things like, for example, with kids, we have this worry about this quiescent quasi-particle density, right? And if the quiescent quasi-particle density ends up being large enough that the quasi-particle density is not limited by the creation of them by readout power, but rather by just some quiescent quasi-particle density, then there's a noise term. I have it included here. So that's a worry. That is my biggest worry, because I think all the other pieces are largely under control. We do have to worry about what's the absorption probability for the phonons to get into the film. If that is low and you lose the phonons to the clamps or something else, then that's going to kill you too. But I think most of the factors in those formulae, we actually have them under decent control. So that's for kids. For TSs, I think the concern is, does the... you're limited by thermal fluctuation noise. Does the thermal fluctuation noise go down with temperature the way that you'd expect based on theory? Is there something anomalous there? If we want to use non-BCS superconductors for kids because they might give some gain in responsivity, do they behave in a funny way that we don't understand that makes it hard to predict the performance? So it's all the things that you can't predict when you do the basic theoretical calculations.
So any more questions? Okay, so if no more questions, let's thank Sunil again. And so we'll get back at 11, so 45 minutes roughly.